So, how much time I have for the talk?
The pizza arrives at 6.
All right, so we will try to rush it in. Okay, so I'm going to talk about application, basically, of representation theory. So representation theory is an abstract subject. You can study it for many years. And it's applied in many different areas of science, but it is nice to see some kind of very concrete and real-life application of representation theory. So how representation theory appears in real-life problem, and this is interesting because representation theory, you know, it occupies so many books and so many structures, and you can learn it for so many years, but still to be able to detect a structure from representation theory as it appears in some natural context, this is a highly non-trivial task, because somehow the structure hides there. It doesn't let you see it just obviously that it is there. You have to really somehow play with the problem and just gradually realize if you have enough experience with representation theory, you gradually realize that in fact there is a structure there. You see it. It is camouflaged completely. But you see it, and when you see it, you are able to exploit it and do wonderful things with it. And I'm going to show you one example of such a wonderful thing that you can do when you see some representation theory existing in the setup. So, basically what I'm going to talk about the mathematical aspects of a problem which arises in structural biology. So, the problem is the problem of deciphering the three-dimensional structure of large molecules. The standard method to do it is called X-ray crystallography. In this method, you take many copies of the same molecule and you pack them together in a form of a crystal, which basically means that all the molecules have the same orientation. They are all looking at the same direction. And then you take this crystal and you project a beam of X-ray on it, and then you get a diffraction pattern, and then you rotate the crystal, you get another image, you rotate the crystal, you get another image, and you collect these images. And from these images, there is an operation, mathematical recipe to reconstruct the basic three-dimensional structure of the basic unit which composed the crystal. This is called X-ray crystallography, and it's very successful, and people won many Nobel Prizes about elaborating over this method. And it works very well. The problem is that there are certain molecules, especially those which come from biology, which do not crystallize very well. Some of them you cannot even crystallize at all. So you cannot apply X-ray crystallography, and people are looking for alternatives. And this is very important because you really want to study the three-dimensional structure of, for example, of proteins, of viruses, or all these kinds of creatures. But you cannot do it with X-ray crystallography, so people are looking for alternatives, and one of these alternatives is called three-dimensional cryo-electron microscopy, and this is the general topic of this talk. So what is the experimental setup? So you have an electron microscope, which you can think of as a tube which projects a high-energy beam of electrons, and downstairs you have a thin plate of ice inside which you have many copies of the same molecule which are immobilized in random orientations. Now this beam interacts separately with each of the molecules. Now the molecule is destroyed as a result of the interaction because the organic material is very sensitive, and you pick up a projection image which encodes the diffraction pattern of the beam from the molecule, and in this way you end up with collection of images each associated with a different molecule in the solution. And you have these images, and what you want to do, you want to take this collection of images and reconstruct the basic three-dimensional unit out of them. Now, there are two basic problems involved in this procedure. So the first problem, this is a real problem, by the way. If you're able to solve it, you do some, it's scientific revolution. So the first problem in this method is noise, namely, these images are very, very noisy. The SNR, the signal-to-noise ratio of these images is very, very low, 1 over 100, something like that. So in fact, if you look at these bare images, you don't see a signal at all. It's just a blur of dots. Okay, you cannot detect anything. This is one problem. But you have many, many of these images. Okay? The second problem, let's say that the images are reasonable. Okay, so you have some signal. The second problem is that you don't know the orientation of the molecule which produced every image. Okay? If you knew the orientation which produced every image, then you are basically reduced to the situation of X-ray crystallography. Okay? But you don't. The molecules are immobilized in orientations which you have no control over, and you don't know the orientation, you are just given the images. Okay? So in this talk, what I'm going to focus about this problem. I'm going to assume that the noise, there exists some noise, but it's not completely insane. So you have some signal, and I will try and I will focus about the problem of reconstructing the orientations. You are given images, and you want to know which orientation produces every image. And after you know this orientation, basically you are done, because you can use the same method of X-ray crystallography, if you're able to do it. Okay? So let me tell you, so this is a mathematical talk. I'm going to use some terminology for mathematics. So everybody understand this setup? Yes, it's clear. Okay. So what is the terminology that I'm going to use? So I'm going to know the node by VR, the three-dimensional Euclidean vector space. So you can think just about V as R3, equipped with the standard inner product. Okay? And I'm going to the node by SR of X, it's the frame manifold associated with X. Or if you wish, this is the group SO3. So a point in frame X is just an orthonormal basis E1, E2, E3. Okay, so this every point in this manifold, every point in this set is just a frame. And I'm going to explain the meaning of this, the physical meaning of this frame in a moment. And this is E1. This is E2, and this is E3. And the first vector is special. I will denote it by pi of x, and I will refer to it as the viewing direction of the frame. The name will be clear in a moment. Okay? And the last piece of terminology that I'm going to use in this talk is I'm going to identify every frame with the following map. I'm going to call it iota x. And this is an orthogonal map from R2. Into V, and how this map is defined? Well, it sends a pair of coordinates PQ into PE1 plus QE2. Namely, I'm using the first two vectors of the frame in order to map the standard plane into the three-dimensional vector space. Okay? Basically, so I'm going to think about a frame in this way. This is one another equivalent way to think about a frame. Every frame give me an embedding of R2 into V using the first two vectors. Okay, so now, what is the mathematical model behind this setup? So as it turns out, instead of thinking about many, many molecules which are immobilized in different orientations and observed by a fixed microscope, it's more convenient to think about, it's equivalent, but more convenient, think about a single molecule, which is a volume fixed in space, and now observed by an electron microscope from various orientations. So now the orientation is associated with the configuration of the microscope and not with the configuration of the molecule. The molecule is fixed, okay? And you observe it, and you take the microscope and observe it from here, you take the microscope, observe it from here, and just you take many, many orientations of the microscope, okay? So this is somehow the convention that I'm going to take. And under this convention, this is the mathematical model. So the molecule, which is fixed now, it's a volume, is modeled by a real-valued function phi on the vector space V. Okay, this is just the volume function. Here it is. Okay, just a volume function. Describe the molecule. A configuration of the electron microscope is modeled by a frame, x in x. So this is, by the way, this x is the frame manifold of V. Sorry, I had a difference. So for me, x is the frame manifold. This is, I'm going to use the name x for the frame. So an orientation of the microscope is modeled by a frame x in x. So now I can explain this name. So E3 is where your eye is located. This is the viewing direction. Okay, this is why I call it E3, the viewing direction. And E1 and E2 establish the coordinates of the camera. So this is a microscope. This is, you look, you view the molecule from this configuration, and you get the picture on these coordinates. These are the coordinates of the camera. Okay? And finally, let's say that you observe the molecule from a specific orientation, then you get a projection image. And what kind of object is the projection image? Well, it's a real-valued function on the coordinates of the camera. It's a real-valued function on R2. Okay? And now this function is defined. This is the model. This is actually the way you describe mathematically the operation of viewing by an electron microscope. This function is the Radon projection of this volume along the viewing direction. Namely, the value. So this is just a crash course on electron microscopy. The value of this function at the point PQ, you just integrate along T of phi PE1 plus QE2 plus TE3 dt. Okay? P and Q are fixed, this is the point, and you integrate phi along the viewing direction, along the coordinate T. Namely, this means that the intensity of the pixels that you get in this image are correlated with line integrals along lines which are parallel to the viewing direction. Is this clear? Am I making sense? Okay, so if you have question, ask. I will probably answer. All right. So this is an image. And finally, just the data that you collect from the experiment is just collection of projection images. Ix, where x runs, and these images are labeled by frames. Okay? So x runs in some finite subset of the frame manifold. Okay? Now, it's very important to note at this point, that at this point, we are given the images. The images are just functions on R2. At this point, we don't know the frame associated with every image. If we knew the frame associated with every image, then we could place it in its right place in the three-dimensional space V, and then apply the inverse radon and reconstruct the molecule. So we don't know the frames. So we are going to treat X here as a suggestive notation. We are going to treat this label X as a suggestive notation, which reminds us that the image is associated with a particular frame, but we still don't know it. Okay, this is what we are trying to know. This is what we are trying to calculate. So the main computational problem is, the goal, if you wish, is to compute for every image, to compute its label, to compute its corresponding frame. Compute X of the image. You are given the images. What you are given is just collection of images. Here they are. All right? Now you know that every image came from a specific frame, came from a specific orientation of the microscope. You know that every image is embedded in certain way inside V. And each embedding is defined by the frame associated with the image. Okay? So this, what you're trying to compute is these embeddings. Okay? Is this clear? All right. So this is the main problem. So we are given the images, and what we are trying to compute is for every image to compute its corresponding frame, or in fact, more precisely, we don't want to know the frame, we want to know the embedding associated with the frame. Because we actually want to embed the image into V. The frame, that we don't care really about the frame, we are trying to understand the embedding which is induced by the frame. So what we actually want to compute is this iota X from R2 into V, which is associated with this particular image. Okay? Alright, so the algorithm which I'm going to discuss proceeds in two stages. The first stage, I will explain it right now, and the second stage is the main algorithm, and this is basically the mysterious part which involves representation theory, and if we have time I will explain how representation theory governs this algorithm. So the first stage of the solution of this problem involves extracting from the images certain geometric data, which is called the common line data. And this is what I want to explain. Now, so what is the common line data? So, and this was understood, I think, 30 years ago already. So pick two frames, x, y, let's say in x, okay? And let's consider the following configuration. We have the vector space V, and we have two copies of R2 and R2, one embedded into V via iota X, and the other embedded into V via iota Y. All right? Now, the images of these two maps are two subplanes of V, and these two subplanes intersect in a line. Okay? So let's denote this line by L. And this is called the common line associated with these two frames. So L is just the image of iota X intersection the image of iota Y. Okay? Now, to such a configuration, we can define a matrix, let's say going in this direction, which I will denote by CXY. And this is called the common line matrix associated with these frames. And how this matrix is defined? It's defined, in fact, in the following way. You first go from this R2 to V via iota Y. Then you project on the common line. Let me denote it by PL. Okay, the projection. This is a map from V to V. And then you go back via iota X transpose. This is a well-defined map. Okay? Now, what is the geometric meaning of this map? The geometric meaning is the following. You have the common line here, which is a line in V. Now, it has a realization in this. It has a coordinate realization here, and it has a coordinate realization here. So this line appears as a line here and a line here. Do you agree with that? But these two lines correspond to the same common line. So there exists a canonical identification between them. There exists a canonical rank 2 matrix which tells you how to send a point here to a point here because they come from the same line. So this is this matrix. If you think about the geometric meaning of this matrix, this is what this matrix computes. It computes this canonical identification of the two coordinate realization of this single common line which exists here. Is this clear? Okay? Now, what is neat about this matrix? The neat thing about this matrix is that you can actually compute it from the images. Okay? Let me explain that. So we have the potential function phi here. And we have the image ix here. This is one image that we have. This is the radon projection. And we have the image iy here. Alright? Now let's take the three-dimensional Fourier transform of phi here. Let's take the two-dimensional Fourier transform of ix here. And the two-dimensional Fourier transform of iy here. Here's the claim. These functions are the restriction of this function to this R2 and this R2 respectively. And this is called the Fourier slicing property, which basically says that Fourier transform interchange restriction and integration. This is homework for you. Just convince yourself that these functions, which is the Fourier transform of the radon projection, are the restriction of this function to this R2 via iota y, and this function is the restriction of phi check via iota x. Just restriction. Easy. Alright? But there is a consequence to that. This means that these two functions must coincide, must agree on the common line. They must agree on the common line because they are the restriction of a single function. Which means that you can use them in order to compute this canonical identification. How do you do that? You look for a line here. And you look for a line here, or maybe more precisely, you look for a direction vector here, and a direction vector here, on which these two functions strongly correlate. You just search one direction in this R2, another direction in this R2, and you compute the correlation between these two functions along this direction. Until you find a pair of directions in which you get a peak, boom, they strongly correlate. Then you know that these two directions correspond to one another. So you can define this matrix by just sending this direction, V, into U. So take it U times V transpose. And this will give you the common line matrix. So the upshot is that the common line matrix can be computed from the images. So what does it mean? It means that we have the images. We know that each image is embedded in some way, but we don't know this embedding. But what we can, but actually, from the images, we can compute for every ordered pair of images, we can compute a 2x2 matrix. And this 2x2 matrix is some kind of a geometric relation between the two unknown frames. We don't know the frames, we don't know the embeddings, but for every pair of images, we can compute from the images a certain geometric relation between the embeddings. Do you understand that? We don't know the embeddings, but from the images we can compute a 2x2 matrix for every pair of images. And this 2x2 matrix relates the two embeddings. It has a geometric meaning. Alright? So, just to conclude, from the images, we are able to compute a collection of 2x2 matrices, which I called CXY, for every XY in XN. So again, this XY now represent labels. Secretly, we know they are frames, but we can just think about them as labels. Each such label corresponds to an image. For every ordered pair of images, we have a 2x2 matrix. Rank 1 matrix, and this is the meaning of this matrix, by the way. It's the common line matrix associated to the two unknown frames. Okay? Good. So now we can... I will move to... Okay, let's erase. So let me describe now the algorithm. If I'm able to describe the algorithm, then I'm only left to explain why the meaning of it, and hopefully we will have time to do that. But this depends on you. So here is the algorithm. You know what? Okay, so... Alright, so what this algorithm does, it takes the common line matrices, and it should compute out of them the orthogonal embeddings. This is what we are trying to compute. All right? Two remarks. One remark, this problem is non-linear. In fact, it's non-convex, because what we are trying to compute is orthogonal embeddings, and the orthogonality condition is a non-linear condition. To compute something which is orthogonal, it means that it satisfies orthogonality relation, and orthogonality relation, for everybody who did some optimization in his life, is a non-linear relation. It's in fact non-convex. So this is a very difficult optimization problem. It's a non-convex problem. Okay, so if you try to apply these standard tools from MATLAB, it won't solve it. Alright? And so this is non-linear, if you wish. And the second problem is the high level of noise. Namely, remember that the images are noisy, which means that everything that you compute out of them is noisy. Namely, these matrices that we compute from the images are, of course, only noisy perturbation of the true common line matrices which relay the corresponding frames. They are not really the corresponding common line matrices. They are noisy perturbation of them. Some of these matrices are just junk. Some of the matrices that you compute from the images is just junk. In fact, let me tell you a secret. 99% of the matrices that you compute from the images is junk. By junk, I mean they don't approximate anything. They are just meaningless. You can put your name there. Okay, instead of the matrix, it will be as meaningful as these matrices. Okay? So, keep the, no, it's not that I'm saying that you are not meaningful, okay? But I'm just, put my name there, if you wish. All right? So, but this is just to convey to you, convey is a nice English word, to convey to you that these, that really you are dealing here with a high level of noise. Okay, so the algorithm should be stable to high level of noise. This is something which you impose on this algorithm. It shouldn't be just a computer science kind of algorithm which works in perfect scenario. It should work under severe conditions of noise. Alright? And by the way, to teach you something, when you impose noise into the setup, it brings completely different mathematics into play. If you ignore noise, then you can solve everything in a trivial manner. Also this problem, by the way. But when you put noise, then you have to think about the thing in a completely different way. And this is a general principle. Alright? Okay. So, let me tell you, before I even describe the algorithm, let me tell you the main idea. Because this algorithm really represents a novel paradigm, a different paradigm in optimization. So let me tell you the main idea. What we are going to do, we are going to compute out of the images or out of the common line data, we are going to construct a three-dimensional Euclidean vector space. This three-dimensional Euclidean vector space is very different than the vector space V that we started with. And what we are going to do, we are going to compute these orthogonal embeddings in the coordinates of this new vector space that we constructed. This vector space is not V. We are going to compute embeddings into this new vector space. And what we are going to construct is not what we want, of course, but it is related to what we want. It's not equal to what we want. It is isomorphic to what we want. And this is what I will try to explain. Okay, so somehow the solution of the problem is going to be rather sophisticated. Okay? We are not just going to compute iota x. We are going to compute a vector space, maps into this vector space, and then somehow related to what we actually want. And this, hopefully, I will be able to explain that. Alright, so here is the algorithm. The algorithm proceeds in three simple steps. First step, you construct a big, what we call an ambient vector space. Just a stupid vector space. I will denote it by HN. And this vector space is just R2 valued functions on the set of labels. Or if you wish to think about it more concretely, you have a collection of images. Each image is just a function on R2. Just sum up all these R2s. These R2 associated with the label DX1, these associated with the label DX2, up to XN, if you wish. Just sum up all these R2s together. And this is just a more abstract way to think about it. This is R2 valued function on the set of labels. But this is just R2 to the N. A big Euclidean vector space, meaningless, completely meaningless. Alright? Now comes something interesting. We are going to construct, we are going to take the common line data, we have to do something with it, we are going to use it to construct an operator acting on this vector space. I will denote it by C of N. It goes from HN to HN. It's a 2N by 2N matrix. And how do I define this matrix? As follows. Basically, it takes an R2 valued function f and sends it to a new function whose value at the point x is 1 over n, sum over y in xn, cxy f of y. This is how it is defined. And if you want to be really concrete about it, this is just a 2n by 2n matrix. And how this 2n by 2n matrix is defined? 2n by 2n, you put in the ij place, you put the matrix cij. This is what you do. You take the ij coordinate and you stick inside it the common line matrix associated with the I image and the j image. Okay, and in this way, you paste all these 2 by 2 matrices together into a big 2n by 2n matrix. Alright? And it is easy to check that the matrix that you get is symmetric. Easy to check, because the common line matrices, somehow the procedure to construct them is a symmetric procedure. So this is a symmetric matrix. Okay, and now comes the final stage. And this is where the magic happens. So, here it is. Three. I told you I'm going to construct a three-dimensional Euclidean vector space. This is the way I'm going to do it. Well, Cn, it's an operator on Hn, and it's a symmetric operator, so it admits a spectral decomposition. So this Hn decomposes into eigenspaces. Hopefully you know what it is. Very, very important thing in linear algebra. If you have an operator, a symmetric operator, it has a spectral decomposition. You can diagonalize it. So you have a decomposition of the vector space into eigenspaces. And I'm going to define Vn to be the following portion of the spectrum. I'm going to sum up all the Hn lambda for lambda greater than 1 over 3. Why 1 over 3? Well, 1 over 3 is not special. The only attribute that it satisfies is that it lies between 1 half and 1 over 12. Okay. These two numbers have meaning. I will explain this meaning later. I can tell you briefly what is the meaning of these two numbers. If you take n to infinity, this C of n will converge to an integral operator. And the maximum eigenvalue of this integral operator is going to be 1 half. And the second highest eigenvalue of this integral operator is going to be 1 over 12. And what I'm doing here, I'm picking all the portion of the spectrum which belongs to 1 half. This 1 half has multiplicity 3 in the limit. We will come to that. Okay? But the basic theorem is, I will have to justify it, is that if you take this portion of the spectrum, the dimension of Vn is equal 3. It's a three-dimensional vector space. Now, if you want to be really concrete, don't use this definition. Just take this operator and take the three maximal eigenvectors of this operator. This operator have eigenvectors, take the three highest ones. Take them, they span a three-dimensional vector space, this is this vector space. Okay, so don't say it, all this nonsense. Take the three highest eigenvectors, put them together into a vector space, this is the three-dimensional vector space that I want to talk about. Okay? Good. So I have this vector space, it's a three-dimensional vector space, and now I have to compute the embeddings. I told you, I'm going to compute the embeddings into this vector space. How am I going to do that? I take Vn. It's not arbitrary. Vn is a three-dimensional subspace of Hn. Remember, Hn is R2 cross R2 cross R2 n times. N is the number of images. Agree? Everybody is with me now. This is the most important part of my talk. So you have to really be focused. Okay, this is a magic. Now I'm going to do some magic. So Vn is a subspace here. Do you agree with me? This side agree? The middle agree? This side agree? Very good. Nothing in my sleeve. Nothing in my... All right? Okay. Pick an image. Pick an image. It's associated with some label. But pick an image. To this image, you have the orthogonal embedding from Hn, P of x. An image associated with the label x. Pick an x in xn. So you have the image associated with this label. So you have the orthogonal embed, the orthogonal projection on the x copy of R2. You just project R2 to the n to the x copy of R2. Just coordinate projection. Alright? So this projection gives you a map. Let's call it pi of x tilde. Well, from Hn to R2, but you can restrict it to Vn. From Vn to R2. Do you agree with me? If you restrict this coordinate projection on the x copy of R2, it gives you a linear map from Vn to R2. Now, this is an Euclidean vector space, true? R2, that's the standard inner product. This is also an Euclidean vector space because it's a subspace of an Euclidean vector space. Now, if you have a linear map from one Euclidean vector space to the other, you can define a map in the opposite direction, which is called the transpose. So let's define phi of x. to be P of X tilde transpose. This is the definition of transpose requires Euclidean structures. Okay? Knowing linear algebra is very important. This is my message to you. Okay? Come to my class. Anyhow, you can define the transpose. And the transpose goes from here to here. Everybody agree with that? So let's summarize what we obtained from this very, very simple algorithmic procedure that every one of you can compute in MATLAB. We constructed a three-dimensional vector space, Euclidean, which is a subspace of this R2 to Dn. And for every label x, we constructed a map phi of x from R2 into this Vn. For every x in xn, for every image if you wish. Do you agree with me? Are you convinced that you can do it yourself? Until here, you can do everything yourself. Compute this thing, build the common line matrix, you can do it. Alright? So this is what we constructed. Here is the upshot. The upshot is that the problem is solved. In what sense it is solved? This is the content of the following theorem. Well, this is not V. This is not V. And these are not iota. So what am I talking about? Okay, I didn't give you V, I didn't give you iota, I just gave you something and something else, and I'm throwing it on you and tell you, take it and, you know, do whatever you want to. No, so this is a solution, and this is the sense by which it is a solution. It's a solution in the following sense. And this is a mathematical theorem which I will have to justify. This is the main theorem. Namely, there exists a unique, this is the way you write unique, okay, to save chalk, there exists a unique linear isometry, tau, which goes from V, this is the R3, this is the physical space R3 that we started with, into Vn, this map is linear. This is the vector space that we constructed. There exists a unique such map, which satisfies the following property. That for every label X, you have R2, you have the iota x into v, which you are trying to compute, and you have the phi of x into vn, which you actually computed from the data. And the claim is that there exists a unique isometry from v to vn, which makes this diagram commute for every label. Now think about this statement. I'm claiming that there exists such an isometry. Grant it. Later we are going to construct it. Grant the existence of such isometry. If you grant the existence of such isometry without knowing what it is, you already ensure that if you computed this side, in fact it determined this side up to one global rotation of all the iotas. If I constructed to you this side of the diagram, which I did, and I grant the existence of such a tau, this means that from this side I can compute all the iotas up to some ambiguity, which is a fixed rotation of all of them. One rotation which rules them all. Alright? Not a different rotation for every iota. One rotation for all the iotas. Which basically means that we solve the problem, because this means that up to one rotation, I can embed all the images, up to one rotation of all of them, which in fact means that I can reconstruct the molecule up to rotation, which is okay. Is this clear? Good. This is the algorithm. And hopefully it is mysterious. Okay, hopefully I have to explain where this, why. Well, I constructed all kinds of things, but the basic mystery is why this Vn and this phi are related to iotas in this way. Do you agree with me that this is a mysterious fact? Alright? And this is what I will try to do in the next 15 or 10 to 15, depends on you, 10 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes. So basically the upshot is that representation theory explains that. Alright? In fact, the whole algorithm cannot really be invented without some insight from representation theory, although it was invented without insight of representation, so I'm contradicting myself here. But anyhow, never mind. Some more sophisticated algorithms of this nature really require you to understand the structures. But this one actually was invented by applied mathematicians without knowing anything about representation theory. But still, it was not presented like that. Anyhow. Okay. So here is the explanation. Okay, I can spend some time explaining why it is stable to noise, but I'm not going to do that. Okay? This is a very stable procedure. I will say maybe a few words about it in the end of the talk. Okay, extremely stable. Namely, this procedure computes the iotas in a very precise manner, even if 99% of the matrices are just wrong. Completely wrong. Okay? Highly stable. So this is the nice thing about this procedure, otherwise it won't be interesting. It will be a nice mathematical kind of discussion, but nothing really practical. Okay, so here is the explanation. The explanation is based on considering the continuous limit when the number of images goes to infinity. What happens in the limit? Well, this is the roadmap. The configuration space Xn, which is just a finite subset of frames, now let's admit these are frames, these converge, if you wish, measure theoretically to the frame manifold, to the Hall of X. Let's assume that the orientation are distributed independently and uniformly at random. So this finite set, in fact, cover nicely and uniformly the whole frame manifold. Okay, so in the limit it converts to the frame manifold. Now this Hn, remember, which is R2 valued function on Xn, converge in the limit to R2 valued function on X. This is just H. Okay, so now I do remember that the labels are frames, yes? And then we have this common line operator, which was cooked out of the common line data. Well, this guy converged to an integral operator from H to H, which is basically given by the same formula. It is given by the kernel CXY, where CXY is the common line matrix relating the frames X and Y. Do you agree with that? In the limit, this is, if you wish, Riemann integral formula. This finite integral operator will converge to this infinite integral operator, which is given by the same kernel. If you wish, this is just a sampling of this operator. Okay? And finally, we took Vn, and what this Vn converges in the limit, so for every n, we have this three-dimensional vector space. Well, in the limit, this three-dimensional vector space converges to the maximal eigenspace of this operator. I'm just summarizing for you the facts. Now, what do I gain by moving to the continuous site, which I don't have in the finite site? Well, the gain is that if I look at what happens in the continuous site, a new structure emerges, and this structure is an action of the special orthogonal group, SO3. V is R3, so this is just SO3. So if SO3 acts on everything here, as I'm going to explain. So I can use the representation theory of SO3 to interpret this vector space. I'm going to interpret this vector space. Right now, it's just the maximal eigenspace of some operator. This is quite a meaningless thing to say about a vector space. The maximal eigenspace of some operator. Okay, what else? What can you say about it? No. So we are going to interpret this vector space in terms of representation theory of SO3, and this interpretation will explain the algorithm. So this is what we are going to do. Okay, so let's do that. So Xn converges to X. So basically, so this is the configuration space. So indeed, X is the limit. And what do we have about X? Well, we have an action of SOV from the left. Namely, if you have a frame, E1 and E2 and E3, and you have an element G, it acts on it by rotating every vector. Okay? In fact, secretly, there is another action of SO2 from the right, which I have to consider, which is rotating along the viewing direction. Forget about it. Not important. Okay, I just want to convey the main message. Okay, so we have an action of SOV. This is very nice. We don't have this action on Xn. Xn is a finite subset. No action there. On the limit, suddenly we have an action of a group. So this is something nice. Let's not take it lightly. Okay. Now what happens to the... to the ambient vector space? Well, it converges to R2 valued function on X, and this action on the manifold gives you an action of SOV on H. Just given a function, rotate the coordinates of this function, rotate the variables. This is what is called the representation. So SOV acts on H. Okay, this is called this. So H is the representation space of SOV. Now, if you SOV is a compact group, so now let me give you a basic representation theory. If you have a representation of a compact group, it decomposes into irreducible representations. What are irreducible? So let me just write. So H decomposes into a direct sum. This is general fact from representation theory. You have an action of a compact group on a Euclidean vector space, or let's say a Hilbert space. Then the Hilbert space decomposes into a direct sum of subspaces, where each subspace is closed under the action of the group. If you act with the group SOV on this subspace, you stay there. And each of these subspaces cannot be decomposed further. So this is an irreducible representation. Okay? Now you take the irreducible decomposition of this Hilbert space. So you have this decomposition, and let me tell you the basic theorem. Okay, and each of these subspaces is an irreducible representation, but the main theorem, which comes from the representation theory of this space, is that each of these representations is different. Okay? There are no two representations here which are the same. This is called multiplicity one. Namely, each of these representations here, which is irreducible, all of them are distinct. And in particular, I will say that the dimension, the HN representation, is the unique irreducible representation of SOV of dimension 2N plus 1. So each representation, in fact, what happens here is that each representation of SOV appears here with multiplicity 1. Okay, and I denote by HN the representation of dimension 2N plus 1. This is called spherical harmonics, by the way. Okay? Am I making sense? All right. Let me tell you what this is similar to. Think about a natural number. If you have a natural number, you can decompose it into multiplication of primes. Do you agree with me? This is called prime decomposition. The primes are the ones which cannot be decomposed further. The same here. You have a representation of a group, it decomposes into a sum of subspaces which cannot be decomposed further. Now, if you have very special natural numbers, these are the ones which decompose into primes, and each prime appears once. These are very special numbers. These, I don't know the name of the numbers, but they are special, believe me. Okay? You don't have prime powers. Every prime appears once. Not all the primes appear, but the ones which appear once. This is the analog of such numbers. This is a representation where each irreducible component appears once. In particular, in this case, all the representation appear, and each appear once. All right? Good. So now, the main property. And the main property is, let's consider the limit of C, and this is C. And the main property of C, this is, if you wish, it's a claim, it's just an observation, it's very easy to verify, is that C, which is an operator on H, commutes with this action of SOV. CG equal G composed with C for every G in SOV. This is very easy to verify. Just check that the kernel of this operator satisfies the CGX, GY, this is the common line matrix, is CXY for every X, Y, and G. Which means that this operator commutes with the SOV action. Which means that this operator is an intertwiner. And now let me tell you the main fact. When you have such an operator, this is the main fact that you have to remember from representation theory. There are basically two facts. You have an operator and it computes with an action of a group. This means that this operator preserves the irreducible components. Namely, CHN is inside HN. Because it commutes with the group, it respects the irreducible components. This is one fact. And the second fact is, because each of these HN is an irreducible representation, so if you restrict C to HN, it gives you a linear operator from HN to itself, which commutes with the group, but this HN is irreducible, so then there is a lemma which is called Schur's lemma, which tells you that in such a case, CHN is just a scalar. It's just a scalar operator. If you have an irreducible representation of a group, and you have an operator on this representation which commutes with the group, it must be scalar. Alright? Which means, so what is the bottom line? The bottom line is that the eigenspaces of this operator C coincide with this isotypic component, with this irreducible component. Alright? And moreover, if you know this fact, then you can compute, you can use a little bit of representation theory and compute the eigenvalues of C and realize that the eigenvalue lambda n is minus 1 to the n minus 1 times n times n plus 1. Use some hard representation theory to compute this formula. So in particular, you get that the maximal eigenvalue is 1/2, and it is, and the maximal eigenspace is H1, the three-dimensional representation, and the second highest eigenvalue is 1 over 12. These are the two numbers that I told you before, if you use this formula. Okay? And now let's... Yes?
For Schur's lemma, do you not need that
your vector spaces over an algebraically closed field?
In this case, it's true also non-algebraic. You are right. The naive Schur's lemma requires algebraically closed, but it's true also here. Okay? Alright, so now let's prove. So let's prove the algorithm. So I need 5 minutes. Do I have 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Alright. So let's consider the limit of the algorithm. So remember, Vn converge to V, where V is the maximal eigenspace of this operator C. Okay? And this maximal eigenspace, now we know who it is. It is H1. The irreducible representation of S of V of dimension of H1 is equal 3. We know that from the theorem. Okay, the maximal eigenspace of C is this three-dimensional representation of S of V lying inside H. Okay? It's important. Alright, in particular we proved that the dimension of this guy is 3, because this is the three-dimensional representation. Alright. Okay, so now let's look what the algorithm does. In the limit, let's look at the limit of this phi of x, if you wish, the limit. So this is the limit of this phi of x. You have V, and it lies inside H. And now pick a label x in x. H is R2-valued function on x, so you have you remember the orthogonal projection on the x copy of R2? Here it is called evaluation morphism at x into R2. You have an R2-valued function on x, you can evaluate this function at x and get a vector in R2. So this gives you a linear map from H to R2. Let's denote the composition of these two maps by Px tilde. Okay? So I have for every frame x in x, I have Px tilde from V to R2. And now I can define phi x, okay, if you wish, in the limit to be just Px tilde transpose, which goes from R2 into V. So to summarize, Vn together with these collections of map, let's call them phi of xn that I described before, converge in the limit to V together with these maps, phi of x. Okay? And phi of x are defined as follows. You have this V, and you define it in the following way, the same way, basically. And now I want to extend the algorithm, and now I'm going to specify the following theorem, which proves the algorithm. This theorem is very similar to the theorem that we had in the finite setting, with one small change. Namely, I said there exists a unique isometry, now I'm going to say that there exists a canonical isometry tau from V, the vector space that we started with, to V, the vector space which we defined as the maximal eigenspace of C, which coincides with the H1 isotropic component, such that for every frame x in x, you have R2, you have iota x, which is the map defined to this frame, and you have phi of x defined in this manner. You have V inside R2 of x, evaluation, compose, take the transpose. The claim is that there exists a canonical such isometry which makes this diagram commute for every x. And now the proof. The proof is one line. Two lines. I'm going to construct this tau. I'm going to construct it. I couldn't do it in the finite setup. I can actually construct it in the limit. So let me tell you how it is constructed. It's very, very easy. First of all, I'm going to define tau from V to H. Not to V, to H. V is the maximal eigenspace. I'm first constructing a map tau from V into H. How do I construct it? Well, I send a vector V in V into an R2 valued function tau of V. Okay? So this is an R2 valued function. So I have to tell you, so this is a function from X to R2. So let me tell you how this function is defined. Tau of V at the point X is defined as follows. It's iota X transpose of V. This is the way I define it. Okay? Iota x is a map from R2 to V. Iota x transpose is from V to R2. So I take the V. Do you understand this definition? Good. So this gives me a map from V to H. In fact, it's a linear map. And you can easily check that this map commutes between the SOV action here and the SOV action here. It's a map of representations. Very easy to verify. Which means that the image of this map must be isomorphic to V as a representation of SOV. Now, if you look at H, this big infinite dimensional vector space, can you detect in this H an irreducible representation of SOV, which is three dimensional, and it is isomorphic to V? There is one of them. There is only one like such representation. This is H1. H1 was the unique irreducible subspace, which is three dimensional. So the image of tau must be this H1. There is no other choice. The image of tau must be isomorphic to V as a representation of SOV, and there exists only one copy of such representation inside H, so it must be H1. But H1 is the maximal eigenspace of C. So in fact, this tau, which is canonically defined, is a map from V to capital V, which is the maximal eigenspace of V, of C. And why this tau satisfies this property? Well, this is just from the construction. If you look at the construction of this map, the way it is construction is just this property. Read this formula. Take a few minutes when you have time. Just read this formula, look at it in the appropriate angle, and you are going to see this commutation relation. This is just from definition. This thing is from the definition. And we are done. That's it.
Any questions?
It was an anti. I hope it. So again, I'm not expecting you to understand every detail of the explanation. I just want you to get the feeling where representation theory. So representation theory is all around somehow. But you and it's all about how to detect where it is in order to exploit. Yes. Questions. Do you want to know why this algorithm is so stable to noise? For example, let me explain that. It's interesting. So, let's go back to the finite setup. Remember how we cook the solution. We have a big 2n by 2n matrix. Okay? And the way we constructed the solution, we constructed a three-dimensional vector space. And what was this three-dimensional vector space? This three-dimensional vector space, let's remember, this matrix was divided by 1 over n, so let's erase this 1 over n. So the way we constructed the solution is by computing the maximal eigenspace of this matrix, and the maximal eigenspace is around n over 2. It was 1/2, but I multiplied by n is n over 2. Okay? And from this three-dimensional vector space, we cook out the solution. Okay? Now, the second highest eigenspace, if you believe what I told you before, is around n over 12. Remember this number 12. So this is where the second eigenvalue lies. So you have a spectral gap here of order n. A huge spectral gap. Now, in order to construct the solution, you're only interested in this guy. Now, what does it mean to add noise into the picture? It means that you perturb the coordinates of this matrix, which means that you add to this matrix a random matrix, appropriately normalized. It's called the Wigner matrix. Now, if you take one course or you read one book or one, I don't know, random matrices for dummies, the first thing they tell you is something about the spectrum of random matrices. Namely, that the spectrum of a random matrix looks something like that, between square root of n and minus square root of n. So the spectrum of a random matrix is very, very small compared to the spectral gap. So now another fact, if you wish, from linear algebra. If you perturb a matrix by something which has such a spectrum, and you have a spectral gap which is orders of magnitude larger than the spectrum of the perturbation, such a perturbation almost doesn't change this vector space. The highest eigenspace is going to stay still. It's not going to feel the perturbation, because the next thing that can interfere with it is so far away compared to this small spectral perturbation that it's not going to feel it. So this guy is going to stand still, alright, by such perturbation, and this is the reason why this algorithm is so stable. Add, in fact, you can take 99% of these entries and put, again, I told you, junk. This vector space will not move. All the other vector spaces are going to move, but this guy is going to stay still. And this is the only guy that you need. Alright? So this is another nice fact. Oops, sorry. Alright. Done.
Speaker.
Thank you. Do you have general questions? Anything? I'm here already. Yes.
You said that there is an open problem in this field of research.
Oh, everything is open here. Everything is, no, basically, I'm part of a group which is working on this, but basically, what I just described is some of the mathematics which represent an approach to solving the problem, but basically the problem is multifaceted. So, for example, one open problem which we work on, there are some methods to do it, but it's a very difficult problem, is the problem of reducing the level of noise. I told you the images are very, very noisy, and you want to reduce the level of noise. So basically what you want to do, you have this collection, this large collection of images, and what you want to do, you know that every image came from a certain viewing direction, so you want to group together images which came from the same viewing direction. So you want to classify the images into groups where the images in the same group come from the same viewing direction. If you are able to solve this classification problem, then you can take the images in the same group, align them, and sum them up, and in this way increase the SNR. So for example, this classification problem is in fact more important than this orientation reconstruction problem. And this classification problem is to some extent open. Let me tell you another vast open problem. I assumed, again, there are open problems in every step of the way, yes? But for example, in the description of the problem, I assumed that all the molecules in the solution are the same. Namely, I have this thin layer of ice, and I have all these many molecules, millions of them. I can get millions of images. And I told you that all the molecules are the same. Of course, I lied. The molecules, you cannot really come up with a pure solution. The molecules are different. In fact, they are different in a meaningful manner because biological molecules don't admit a single structure. They have different conformation. For example, if you have a protein, so typically a protein, if you look in these PubMeds or all these books, a protein looks like that, blah, 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 blah. And then you have a tentacle. Okay? And a little lie. Yes, it has a tentacle, and then the tentacle have two modes, open and closed, because a protein have a function. So one protein can do like that. This is a very boring protein, but do like that. Another protein do like that. Yes, proteins are such creatures, you know, they have one movement, some of them have more movements, but they dance. So typically when you have a solution with the proteins inside it, the proteins come in all the conformation, in all the relevant conformations. And in fact, what you really want to know, you want to have not a three-dimensional reconstruction, which is a still image. You want to reconstruct a movie of the protein. If something over time, you want to see the protein moving between all its conformations. Okay? But the bottom line is that the solution is not pure. You have different molecules there. And you cannot get rid of that because a protein really always appears in different conformations. Okay? So, when you deal with non-pure solution, so you have to deal also with the problem of classifying the different images to the different conformation. You don't want to put together images which come from different conformation. It will give you some meaningless structure. You want to separate the images to different conformations. So it's a pity I don't have my slides here. But now think about the following situation. You have millions of images. All the images are horribly noisy. Really, if you look at the images, you don't see anything, basically. So what you have to do, the following. First of all, you have to denoise the images. Then you have to classify the images into different conformations. Very, very complicated problem. And then every conformation you have to reconstruct the orientation and etc., etc. And I don't want even to mention the problems which are related to the reconstruction itself. After you compute orientations, you are not even close to be done. So you have to do something else, because in fact the way electron microscope work, I'm just trying to entertain you here. So electron microscope is not built to view molecules. Electron microscope is built, I don't know, to watch things which are much bigger than molecules. It was not designed to watch molecules. So basically what people discovered is that they can use an electron microscope to watch molecules if they defocus it. There is some defocusing procedure. They use it in the wrong way. Alright? And in this wrong way they are able to in fact view the molecules. It's an amazing, if you wish, discovery in this area of technology. So you can use the electron microscope, if you put it upside down and you take this thing part out and you throw it away and you squeeze it, you are able to do something. But this is some kind of a very defocused and distorted way to view the things, and you have to compensate for that. This is just done in order to get some signal, and you have to compensate for this signal in order to actually get the meaningful signal. So this is another problem. So what I'm trying to tell you is that this is a big scientific problem, and in order to solve it, there are so many, many different stages, and each of these stages is a problem on its own, right? But, again, it was it in the sense that this is a big problem, and the solution of this problem is important. Not only for mathematicians, it's important for other people. Okay?
Yeah. What can you tell us about the veil representation?
This is another talk. The veil representation, I can tell you in one line. The veil representation is not a representation of SO3. It's a representation of SL2. 2x2, for example, 2x2 matrices of determinant 1. It's a representation of SL2R acting on L2 of R, if you wish. Now, the nice thing about this representation is that one of the operators in this representation is the Fourier transform. So if you really want, the Fourier transform is an important operator. So if you really want to understand the Fourier transform and all these nasty theorems that they tell you in harmonic analysis, so basically all these theorems can be explained in a very neat manner using representation theory. But to do that, you have to use the veil representation. This is the object in representation theory, which is associated with the Fourier transform. This is why it is so interesting. And another nice thing about it is that it exists over every field. So, for example, this is the continuous Fourier transform, which is nice for mathematicians, maybe. But people are much more interested in engineering, for example, or computer science, with the discrete Fourier transform. True? Everybody here knows about the DFT. Okay? So basically, everything I just said about the veil representation over R is true also over finite fields. Namely, instead of looking at SL2R, you can look at the group SL2 over FP. FP is a finite field. So these are 2x2 matrices, A, B, C, and D, where A, B, C, and D are elements of the field, and the determinant is 1, the unit element in the field. This is a group, the SL2 over the finite field. And there exists a very special representation. This group acts on complex-valued functions, not over the real numbers, but over the finite field. The formulas are very similar to the ones of this representation. Okay? So, this is a representation. Namely, every element of G acts as a unitary operator on this p-dimensional vector space. This is just C to the P, if you wish. Okay? One of these operators, in fact, the operator associated with the matrix 1 minus 1, the operator, this is called the Weyl element, the operator, let's call this representation rho. The operator associated with this Weyl element, it's a unitary operator, and this is the DFT. Now, let me tell you something nice. We are here, so I'm going to tell you. And this is for free. I'm not going to charge you for that. Okay? Look something nice. This is the Fourier transform. Everybody knows the DFT, okay? Everybody. Okay, but let me tell you something that very few people know about the DFT. Look at this element. Can you find elements in SL2FP which commute with it? Think about SL2R. Go to SL2R. Here it's easier. And take the veil element in SL2R. this veil element will represent itself as the Fourier transform in the veil representation of RR. Forget about it. In SL2R, can you give me matrices in SL2R which commute with this guy? This is a very, very basic question. He commutes with itself, thank you very much. This is very, very diplomatic answer, I like it. 1 point for you out of 10. You got something. And you give me something which is not W, which will commute with W.
Zero is on the off diagonal.
What?
Zero is on the off diagonal.
And one, the identity. You are slightly less politically correct than him, but you are still, you know, in a risky, in the risky border. Something which is not identity, not W itself. I will tell you all of them. All the matrices are cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta. All the rotations. This is SO2. This is rotation by 90 degree, and this is a rotation by angle theta. This is a commutative subgroup of SL2R. And these are all the matrices which commute with this guy. The same thing appears here. You have SO2 over SP. And these are collection of matrices here, which commute with this guy. Now, what is the consequence of that? Alright, let me just tell you the consequence. So we have this collection of matrices which commute with this guy, and by the way, they commute with respect to one another. Everything here commute. This is a commutative subgroup. Now, each element here, each element G here, correspond via the veil representation to a unitary operator. You agree with me? In particular, one of these unitary operators is the DFT. The DFT is the guy associated with W. W is part of this group. So we have all these operators which come from the veil representation. One of them is the Fourier transform, and they pairwise commute. So when you have a collection of operators, so first of all, this is something interesting. You have the DFT, and suddenly I'm able to give you collection of unitary operators, which are highly non-trivial, which commute with it. They commute with the DFT. They constitute, for people who come from physics, they constitute a symmetry of the DFT. The DFT admits symmetries, namely operators which commute with it. Okay? But all these operators commute with one another. And now let me ask you a question in linear algebra. When you have a collection of operators which commute with one another, what can you do to them? You can simultaneously diagonalize them. So in fact, you can take all these operators and simultaneously diagonalize them because they commute with respect to one another. And in fact, a theorem tells you, and this is a theorem from representation theory, is that if you simultaneously diagonalize them, the multiplicities are one. If you take only the DFT, you cannot really diagonalize it because the multiplicities are huge. The DFT is an operator of order 4. It has only 4 eigenvalues, plus minus 1 and plus minus I. Every eigenvalue comes with a huge multiplicity, so diagonalization is meaningless. But if you take all these operators, which are God-given, they are canonically defined, you can simultaneously diagonalize them and get actual eigenvectors. Okay? Now, these eigenvectors are in particular invariant under the DFT. And you can ask yourself, wow, I came up with God-given functions, God-given p-dimensional vectors, which are invariant under the DFT. And the question is, what is so special about this function? And the special about this function, so first of all, these are interesting functions. And in order to even come up with them, you have to understand representation theory. But the interesting thing about this function is that although they are completely deterministic, there is some very deterministic structure which produced them, they look completely random. In fact, you can prove that this function can hardly be distinguished from random functions. So they are truly pseudo-random functions, pseudo-random vectors. And these pseudo-random vectors are associated with the DFT and somehow are governed by the veil representation over the finite field. So this was a small lecture inside a lecture. Okay? Okay.